Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. That's 1-800-639-8783. Or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467369.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros, of course. I'm your co-host, Big Waz, a.k.a. Wazzy Lambre, joined as always by my brother, my partner for real, like the Wayans, Nando Vila on the west side of Los Angeles, brother. What's going on?
What's up? Are you enjoying the NBA playoffs?
They've been
pretty fun.
I am.
A lot of great players.
Last night's freaking Jazz game was excellent. It's just been awesome. And like, it's such a stark difference from what the regular season has been, which was like a bunch of teams like, fuck this. We came back 2 months after the last season ended. I don't give a fuck. Two guys literally killing themselves to win every game. I love that.
Yeah.
On today's show, our friend, your former president, Barack Hussein Obama, gave a very long interview to Ezra Klein of the New York Times. I thought it was pretty interesting and fascinating. It's always dope to hear Barry wax poetic about his own legacy, his own presidency. It's just interesting to get into the mind of Obama. We're going to break down that interview. Uber, Airbnb, all of these jobs from the gig economy. New York Times put out a piece that said investors are done losing money. They're tightening the belt, which means higher costs for us, et cetera, et cetera. What that's going to mean going forward, me and Nando are going to get into that. But first, and I know producer Sean is going to play this clip for y'all, Kamala Harris, was she in Guatemala or was the Guatemala president?
She was in Guatemala.
She was in Guatemala. The Guatemalan president was there. She gave a speech in which she told everybody, Nando, don't come to America. Don't cross the border illegally. Do not come. We have a legal means of immigration and refugee policy. Go through that. Don't traverse the dangerous waters of coming to America. We're going to protect our border. We're going to send your asses back. Do not come.
At the same time, I want to be clear to folks in this region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border. Do not come. Do not come. The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border. There are legal methods by which migration can and should occur.
And I talked about this very briefly on Wozni and Nando, and I always love to talk to you about immigration because, you know, I think yours is a very poignant one, and it's just that the Dems are incoherent on the subject matter. They don't have a plan. They don't have an ideology. They don't have a policy. And furthermore, the right is united on immigration. We don't want it in any form, any way. Kick them all out. Don't let any more in. And so they get wrong-footed on the subject time and time and time again. Definitely would love to hear what were your thoughts when you see Kamala Harris talking to a bunch of Guatemalans who, by the way, and I know I'm fucking being long here. It must be said, it can't not be overstated. The conditions under which those people live are largely influenced by the policies of the United States government. Like, you can't disentangle the two. The reason why people want to get out of there and escape crushing poverty and extreme violence and the bullshit drug war is directly tied to U.S. governmental policy. You cannot disentangle the two. So for the American vice president to come there and finger wave and be like, you know, take your border crossing asses back to Guatemala, it's insulting, it's inhumane, it's stupid, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I there's a lot to say about this. And you touched on the most important thing, which is that the conditions in Guatemala, which are pretty horrible, are caused by the United States, have been caused by the United States for decades, starting with the coup d'etat in 1954 of Jacobo Arbenz, which was done by the CIA and in service of the United Fruit Company, which is today Chiquita Banana. I did a big long segment in the Jacobin show about that whole history. But that's putting that aside. First of all, I find it kind of funny that Joe Biden tasked Kamala, his vice president, with.
Come on.
Yeah. He tasked her with like dealing with the border crisis, which is just such a poisoned job. You know, like Joe Biden is kind of a savvy politician. He's an old school politician. He knows that Kamala is a threat to him, you know, that that he wants to run for re-election, and like he doesn't want any sort of anyone suggesting that Kamala should run for, you know, on the top of the ticket in 2024. So he's basically doing what a lot of presidents do, which is send their vice presidents off to do the most unappealing, thankless shit, which is like sending her to Central America to deal with the border crisis, in which that clip of her saying, you know, to the Guatemalans, don't come, is going to be used against her whenever she runs for president, you know, as evidence, rightfully so, of Democratic Party hypocrisy. For fucking 4 years of Trump, we heard about the kids in cages, about how, you know, his vicious immigration policy was evidence of Trump's fascism, that he started his campaign by calling Mexicans rapists, all of which is true. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not like, and Democrats are just fucking, you know, hair on fire about Trump's treatment of immigrants. And I always knew that as soon as the Democrats got back in power, they were going to do the exact same shit. Because why did I know that? Because that's what they did before. Right. There's just no difference. There's like literally no difference between the Democratic Party policy on immigration than the Republican Party on immigration. Like they make like, you know, very small tinkering reforms, like, you know, about the Dreamers, like, you know, children, people who were brought here as babies. Okay, like, you know, okay. But that's like a very small sliver of the overall immigrant population. And, you know, Barack Obama, who we'll talk about later, deported more people than any other president in the history of America. You
the
know,
deporter
by far,
in
by
chief. And by the way, Nando, it must be said that the reasoning given for this, by the way, was we want to come up with sensible immigration policy, and how we show the other side that we're serious about it is that we deport as many brown people as humanly fucking possible. And by the way, because it's always important to point this out, why can't the Democrats make effective arguments to people who don't vote for them when they're the most sensible party? When they watch Democrats talk all this shit about Trump's immigration policy, and they can just be clearly pointed out, like, yo, Barry was doing the same shit before. These facilities, we didn't build these facilities in January of 2017 when this guy got inaugurated. They already existed. This is existing policy being executed. And so when Dems pretend like, heavens, no, not the little brown babies being ripped away from their families, Nando. We have to save them. We can't allow for this. The libs just hate it. Everybody knows they're full of shit. And so when you're constantly just full of shit on policy after policy after policy, and you want people to vote for you and support you when you just do nothing but the most hypocritical bullshit, and then tell them, you know, you're not moral enough or you're a raging racist for not supporting me and my hypocritical, excuse me, lying ass ways. This is why you lose, Democrats. This is why you lose.
Well, I mean, because they do the worst of both worlds, right? Like, they hector people about, like, you know, using the term Latinx or something while deporting, you know, millions of people. But you've heard the term, you've heard the term border militarization, right? You've heard that term, right? It's a real thing that the border has been militarized. Thanks. When did that start? That started in the mid 1990s under the administration of one Bill Clinton, in the wake of the passage of something called NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Organization, which they knew would displace millions of Central American farmers because of the presence of U.S. agribusiness, you know, subsidized U.S. multinational agribusiness corporations flooding Mexico and the rest of Central America with cheap American produced agricultural goods, would displace millions of small farmers in Central America. And they would either have to move to the cities of Central America and try to find jobs, but there's only so many jobs to go around. And the only other choice to go to the United States. So they knew that this was going to create a migration crisis. So a good friend of the show, Rahm Emanuel, who was at the time an advisor to Bill Clinton, who then became Barack Obama's chief of staff and then became the mayor of Chicago and covered up the murder of Laquan McDonald by the police. He actually wrote a big memo to Bill Clinton saying, we need to militarize the border. We need to divert resources to Border Patrol because there's going to be millions of fucking Mexicans coming over here after NAFTA. No, so they knew. It was started by the Democrats. It was enhanced by George W. Bush in the wake of 9/11 because there was this like thing that I remember like hearing people say, like,
ISIS is going to come via Mexico.
They're coming from Mexico. And so we need to do border militarization. And then Obama, and like you said, after George W. Bush, in this like insanely stupid attempt to win over Republican senators and voters by showing how tough he was on the border, deported close to 4 million people. I mean, think of like the forced movement of 4 million people, you know, like from one place to another. It boggles the mind to think about it. And then, of course, we know about Trump. And so, like, it's just been a continuous line started by the Democrats, enhanced by the Republicans, enhanced then by the Democrats, enhanced then by the Republicans, and now again, Kamala. And the thing is about Kamala is that she's being more annoying about it because she's being woke about it. So, like, you know,
But then, you know, the optics of it aren't lost on me, Nando, because like you, I'm the child of immigrants. And so is Kamala. So for Kamala to get up there and be talking all this shit about these people who just want to come to the country and do like her parents did, it's kind of fucking wild to me. Like, the optics of that are just horrible, dude. Yeah. Like, you know, you descend from Indians and Jamaican people, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea that she would get up there and say all of that shit is just, it's incredible to me. And that's not lost on me. And it, again, just the ideological incoherence of Democratic immigration policy is disgusting, and it hurts them. And it hurts you and I in the sense that this is why y'all don't win. Yeah. This is why you guys don't win.
Do you know how many Guatemalans died in the Guatemalan Civil War, which was started after the United States did a coup d'etat, engineered a coup d'etat in Guatemala in 1954? 300,000 people.
Jesus.
300,000 people in a small, very poor country in Central America, dominated by the United Fruit Company, a single American corporation. You know, all the bananas that you eat came from the supermarket came from Guatemala. Essentially slave conditions there by you know, from poor workers. And there was a civil war that was incredibly vicious, in which the U.S.-backed government just like indiscriminately murdered indigenous people there and killed 300,000 people. And we are lecturing them now about, you know, don't come over here. you know, stay in your fucking shithole, because the one that we created, you know, it's just the hypocrisy, the condescension, the moral like abomination of it it drives me crazy, especially to see fucking Democrats doing it. You know, like the right wing all over the Western world has, you know, taken up immigration as its main driving force for support. You know, on some level I get that, but to see Democrats doing it, it's just crazy, especially because they're never going to get credit for it. Like they're never going to get the political credit for it. Like I guarantee you, if you poll Republican voters, they think like Kamala and Joe Biden are support open borders.
Yeah, facts. Yeah. And you know, the another thing about it is like your constituency doesn't give a shit about this. I think that's another sort of huge problem about it, is that the Democratic sort of you know, coalition doesn't really care about immigration. You know, doesn't really care whether those Guatemalans get in or they don't get in. They don't really care what's happening with those people. And so, like, they get wrong-footed all the time. And to the extent that they do, I would say that it's a bunch of those reactionary suburbanites who are just like, do we really need more Guatemalans in the country? Soaking up all our welfare and, you know, raising taxes on people like me who make 450 grand a year? Do we really need it? You know, so to the extent that people do care, I think they're, you know, kind of with Mitch McConnell and the Republicans on it. But, you know, I think we spent enough time on Kamala Harris's horrible finger wagging, hypocritical, just terrible. My God. And we move on to the gig economy. Nando, New York Times put out a piece where they're basically saying all of those cheap Ubers, cheap Airbnbs, cheap DoorDashes, you know, Ubers coming within 2 minutes for $2 to take you to the freaking moon. That's about to be over. As most of you probably know by now, the reason we were getting cheap Ubers is because VCs were subsidizing it. The idea being that we're going to give these people cheap rides. We're going to pay enough drivers to have enough on the road so that it's a quick service, cheap service, get them hooked on it so that we can fire all the drivers and use, you know, autonomous vehicles, right? That was the vision of these companies, by the way. Like, I hope that's not law. They've since pivoted. Like Uber has actually even sold the autonomous car division of the company. So they've pivoted from that. But the original vision of Uber was that they would get a bunch of people on the platform, a bunch of users via these drivers, fire the drivers after they, you know, develop these autonomous cars, i.e. self-driving cars. And so therefore, we don't got to pay for insurance. We don't got to pay wages. We don't got to pay benefits. We don't got to do any of that. These cars are robots. People are going to get in. It's going to be fucking great. That was the vision of this fucking company to start.
Yeah.
Like, as disgusting as that is. So they've since moved on. And as, you know, as I've certainly noticed being here in Los Angeles, less drivers on the road and more costs. And by the way, Nando, I'm getting a car in the coming months. I'm out of here. I'm opting out of Uber. You know, God bless the drivers, all of that. Like, I don't mind paying, but it's like the frequency. And I'm like, nah, I'm done with Uber. But, you know, it just kind of speaks to the sort of bullshit of that entire economy, right? This idea that VCs would just underwrite shit, which just speaks to the ridiculous amounts of wealth these cats have anyway, for a business model that just doesn't make sense. Like I am somebody who thinks there's a utility to connecting people who want to drive people around to the people who need to be driven around. I think there's a use for it. It's clearly not as valuable as what the VCs thought to begin with, you know? And so we're seeing that now.
Yeah. So it's not just Uber, Airbnb, Bird, DoorDash, all of these apps that we've gotten used to in the last couple of years, you know, which I think there's no point in denying it, provide a good service, you know, like that it's nice to be able to like use DoorDash to order food, and it's like a pretty comfortable experience all around, but like, and you know, Bird, that like those like little scooters and whatever and shit like that. And one of the aspects about it is that it's always been remarkably cheap. You know, like everyone always said, like an Uber, it's a better experience than a taxi. You know, you get it on your phone, and it shows up instead of like, you know, going out in the rain and looking for for a taxi on the street. And it's cheaper. It's like, oh my God, like, why wouldn't we do it? You know? And the point is that it's cheaper because it's fake, because it's subsidized. It's not, it doesn't actually make any money. You know how much money Uber lost in 2019? This, I'm not talking about the pandemic year. This is before the pandemic. Their full, the last full year they had pre-pandemic in 2019. You know how much money Uber lost in 1 year? $8.5 billion.
Jesus Christ.
You know what that is? That's them subsidizing cheap rides. You know, because they don't, there's nothing else to Uber. They don't have employees. They don't, they, you know, it's an app, whatever. They, like, all the drivers are independent contractors. But they, what they do is they artificially subsidize the prices for consumers. But that can't last forever. You know, and there's so much money in Silicon Valley. There's so much money in these venture capital funds and stuff that have just made unbelievable amounts of money on, you know, things like Facebook and Google and things like that they don't even know what to do with it. So they're investing it in all these apps, which the only thing that they do is disrupt functioning, healthy businesses, drive them underwater, and then they themselves are just going to replace them, and they're going to jack up the prices. You know, so Airbnb is a mortal threat to, like, the hotel industry, right? And I'm not saying, like, the hotel industry is some great industry, but it worked. Like, it had a functioning, you know, profit system, and, you know, most of their employees are kind of, you know, are unionized. Like in Vegas, for example, like the hotel employees are unionized and things like that. And Airbnb is a mortal threat to all those things. But one of the appeals of Airbnb is that it's cheaper than a hotel. It's cheaper, you know, like, yeah, you don't get someone cleaning your room, and you don't get, like, room service and things like that. But whatever, you know, like, it's so much cheaper to get an Airbnb, and, like, that's ending, because at a certain point, these people need to start making money, and none of those companies do. None of them do. None of them turn a profit. Like, so under capitalism, if you don't turn a profit, you die, you know, and the spigot from VCs seems to be ending. And yeah, I mean, I think it's an overall, like, a positive development, because this kind of artificial subsidies was just unsustainable and was horrible for workers, right? I mean, what they did was basically destroyed industries that were, you know, that had stable employment for these kind of gig industries that don't have stable employment. So, you know, the faster it ends, the better.
Yeah, and I think people that are listening to this need to understand that, like, you know, when you go to Walmart and every register's open, and, you know, there's somebody to help you through the aisles and all of that shit, like, to make your experience convenient, that comes at a cost. And it's usually to the workers. It's never going to be to the Waltons. They're never going to be like, yo, let's provide an incredible service for our customers, and we just make a little bit less. That's never going to be the case. They're just going to be like, no, let's find as much slave labor as we can. And how we execute that is that we put pressure on politicians to make sure the welfare state sucks, and that people, their only choices are between poverty and these fucking jobs, right? And I think it's important that we're conscious of these facts as we're living them, right? Like, you know, when your Uber comes, when your Uber comes in 2 minutes and your driver gives you a great service, but he's paying for his car insurance by himself. He's paying that car note by himself. He doesn't have any health insurance. Like, part of the reason why your shit is so cheap is because of those facts. You know, I think it's important that people are conscious of this, how the economy works. And again, capital has rigged it on the other side to ensure these outcomes. Like, all of this shit about healthcare benefits, the you know, the social safety net, et cetera, housing, all of that stuff. Capital doesn't want government investment in those things because they would prevent people from going to work at McDonald's for $7.50 an hour and cooking those greasy ass burgers in that hot ass kitchen. They would stop people if they had a universal basic income, if they could get healthcare otherwise, if they could find affordable housing, all of those other things. You just wouldn't take that job. They would have to lift the standard of those jobs if government helped us with that.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important that our listeners understand this basic fact, You know,
yeah.
When you think like, you know, I remember people saying like, nobody should make $15 to work at McDonald's. Like normal working people. And that's because they were getting 22 to do some fancy job that they probably got a degree for. Not that the job was actually fancy, but you know what I mean? And it's just like,
yeah, yeah.
No. The people that are paying you 22 could actually would have to afford to pay you more. That's the line that nobody ever wants to draw. If McDonald's was offering 19, they couldn't offer you 22 to do your job. You would have to get paid more. And I keep telling this story about the young woman, because I do work for Spotify now, the young woman who I met at the sort of networking powwow that we had for new employees. Young woman, lives in India, owns her apartment, by the way. I didn't ask how old she was, but I would bet she was my age or younger. Owns her apartment, by the way, in Sweden. And she was just like, yeah, like health insurance isn't a thing here. So I was like, yo, Spotify is great, Benny's. She's like, what you guys consider to be great Benny's, like the standard in Sweden is 13 months for maternity leave. And for paternity leave, it's mandatory you don't come in for 3 months. It's mandatory. You're not allowed to come into work for three months after your baby is born. Like these fringe benefits that y'all see jobs is giving out, we don't see those as benefits. So therefore, employers have to up the ante. They have to actually make their jobs appealing. And so, like, I say all of that to say, like, this, all of these things are interconnected, right? Like the way that Uber gets to treat people and use us as a way to manipulate it, as a way to be like, fuck that. I don't want my Uber going up. I don't want this going up. Like, it's always framed from the viewpoint of capital, employers, it's the job creators, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just think it's important for people to keep that shit in the back of their minds.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, the big fundamental change that has happened in America and in a lot of places really since the 1970s, what we call the neoliberal era, was to turn people from political subjects or citizens into consumers, right? To see themselves first as consumers and not as citizens or political subjects or members of a class or, you know, things like that, as individual consumers. So often, you know, things are framed as like, this is better for you as a consumer. But is it better for you as a class? You know, like that's never the case. And often the things that are better for you in the short term as consumers, maybe slightly more convenient or whatever, as a consumer, will ultimately in the long term have a detrimental effect on your life as a class, because it means lower wages. It means, you know, less protections. It means less welfare benefits. It means all the things that make people lead stable lives go away. But you get the quick Uber ride at your door, you know, like that's the trade-off. And I don't know that it's a trade-off that most people would make if they saw themselves as part of a coherent social organism rather than just kind of as individual atomized consumers.
And again, your job is able to, because one, I just saw it today in the Times again, Uber is ratcheting up their lobbying efforts, Uber and Lyft and the rest of them, to ensure the status quo of how their basically their relationship between the drivers. They're trying to lock that in, right? And again, how does that affect you? Your person at your job could be like, you could always go drive Uber. Yeah. That's what they're going to say to you at your fucking job. That's literally what the bosses are going to say. And, you know, I can tell you this firsthand as somebody who just recently switched jobs and had a contract negotiation, blah, 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 blah. Literally, they'll say this shit to you.
Yeah.
Literally. They will literally tell your ass, you can always go drive Uber. You know, without not that they're explicitly stating that, but it's the undertone is always there. You know, you can either do this, or you can take a gig economy job and be miserable. Relatively speaking, you got it pretty good.
Yeah.
Slave. You know, Massa House down the block, they don't get to eat the good parts of the pig. They don't. They don't get to have the. They don't. They don't never get no steak tips. You crazy? So but it's constantly what they're doing. When you hear the hand wringing about people not going back to work and blah blah blah. Me and Nando gonna get into that next week. But people not going back to work and blah blah blah. It's like that's what they're referencing, guys.
Yeah.
They're basically like, yo, these people don't want to take the slave jobs no more. What the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. It's and leverage. So
it's all leverage. And you should always see everything is that. They're trying to leverage everything against us. It's them versus us. It's the bosses or, you know, because Frank Luntz is such a fucking genius. Not the bosses, the job creators.
Yeah.
It's the job creators versus us. But we move on because we wanted to spend a little bit of time. Did you have anything else to throw in there?
No. Move on, baby.
We wanted to spend a little bit of time on Barry because you guys know Barry's a pet fascination of ours on this podcast. And he went on Ezra Klein's show to do basically – it's not a post-mortem on his presidency, honestly. It's a political commentary of the current moment. Mm-hmm. And they kind of a little bit, Nando, get into Barry's own influence on it, kind of, but not really. But it's basically, and I think honestly, Barry has poignant thoughts on what's going on right now.
Yeah.
He's a smart guy. It's obvious that he's still plugged in and that he gets it on a fundamental level. He deeply understands our political moment, 100%. But Ezra Klein, as we, in not so nice language, talked about in our personal exchange, Nando, didn't do a good enough job interrogating Barry on his own role in this. A lot of it felt like, well, I can't help but the weather. I can't help that the sun comes up every day, even though I was the most powerful man on the planet for 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think what really struck me about that whole exchange, which is worth listening to, it's like an hour long
You need to listen to it. Interview. You should listen to it. Everybody should listen to it.
What both Ezra Klein and, of course, Barack Obama take as given was that Obama achieved the best that was possible. Not the best he could, the best that was possible theoretically, you know, as in his presidency. Yes, because... You know, they talk a lot about the rise of the Tea Party, and they talk a lot about the role of race in the rise of the Tea Party. And of course, that's part of it. That, of course. But what also fueled the Tea Party, not just like its rise, but its kind of lasting impact on American politics, was the fact that Obama bailed out the banks and didn't bail out the homeowners. Mm-hmm. You know, that there was a foreclosure crisis that they did nothing to stop, which they could have easily. Like, it's easily they could have stopped it. You know, this idea that they had no choices is absolute bullshit. And
by the way, Nando, in the midst of that, they let bankers go on TV and say a bunch of fucking idiots took out loans they couldn't afford. And Nando brought it up on previous shows. We used to think of debtor and debtee as symbiotic. It's a two-way street. Yeah. It's not just that somebody takes money that they can't afford to pay back. It's that somebody loans them money that they know they can't afford to pay back.
Well, not just that, but the creditor was seen as the villain in that exchange.
In that exchange.
Throughout history. You know, like usury and lending people money and charging interest was illegal for like throughout the Middle Ages. Bro, and
listen, you know, the Jews are still dealing with that backlash. Centuries later.
But the reason why the Jews were the bankers was because they were not subject to like a medieval Catholic law or whatever. So they were allowed to do this. You know, often they were, you know, it's a whole thing that's not worth getting into. But like throughout history, the creditor was seen as the villain in this exchange. But very subtly, lately in America, the debtor has been seen as the villain and the creditor has been seen as just a fact of life.
You loaded up on debt. You're spending beyond your means. You're a piece of shit for that. And it's like, no, the credit card companies were very predatory and even giving that to you. You're like, shit, I could get some extra money to help me with some bills. People are like, that's irresponsible.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, yeah, the credit card companies knew what they were doing the whole time. And then again, by the way, when they load up on debt that they can't pay back, the US government sweeps in immediately.
Yeah. So that's the fundamental problem that I have with this whole thing is that, you know, the central flaw of Obama and the sort of original sin of Obama, which happened in the first year of his presidency, was that he bailed out the bankers, no strings attached. They didn't even put strings on their bonus pay. They were paying themselves bonuses with the bailout money. Okay. Obviously, not a single one went to jail. All that shit has been repeated a million times. But if you're gonna do that, you have to bail out regular people, and they did not, you know. And so that's like the fundamental thing. Not to mention his immigration policy. Not to mention the Affordable Care Act, of which the only really good thing in the Affordable Care Act was the Medicaid expansion, which was shut down by the Supreme Court, and then you know most half the states didn't even adopt it. Mm-hmm. So the rest of it was just this kind of like bullshit handout to pharmaceutical insurance companies, really, that forced people, like middle-class people, to pay into money that they didn't really have into these like insurance exchanges for insurance that had like a $10,000 deductible. So like they couldn't even pay that anyway. So that's why it made people so angry, because it's like, why am I forced to pay for something that's like is not helping me out at all? Aside from all that, the only calculus that is made on things like the rise of the Tea Party, which then led to Trump, obviously, and you know the current political moment, is exactly how racist are people, right? Like, and that's a factor in it, but it ignores the real fundamental kind of
that you didn't
policy
do shit.
Failures that you didn't do shit fundamentally. So, and the fact is, like, you know, as racist as people in America can be, Obama won two elections where he won the white working class vote both times, you know? And so these conversations are always around identity and never around hard brass tacks policies that can improve people's lives. And does Obama ask himself that question? No.
But he's talking out of both sides of his mouths too, in the sense that when Ezra Klein asks him if he thinks people are persuadable, he's like, yo, if you actually do shit like for people, it's gonna get through. Like if you do stuff for them, you know, because they talked about like when they tried to, like when the Republicans got the House, the Senate, the presidency, when they went out and they tried to gut the things that people actually liked in Obamacare, they couldn't. So there was an actual nod to the fact of like, as racist as people are, they didn't want to get rid of pre-existing conditions. They wanted to keep their kids on the fucking insurance until they were fucking 40. They wanted to, like, you know what I'm saying? Like the things that were great that they could materially feel, there was nothing the Republicans could do. You could call Barry a socialist, terrorist, Kenyan, Muslim, you know, lazy N-word, and you still couldn't take it away. The people still felt the material impact of those policies. Yeah. So at the same time, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth, you know. And again, there's no, like, the way they just glossed over, like, well, we had to bail out the financial. You know,
that's just a given. That's just a given.
Right. The way that that's talked about is a given. Like this idea, like this is what nobody ever wants to talk about. It's like we watched Wall Street be completely roaring, soaring, killing it throughout during the pandemic while everybody's lives were unaffected, were not made better. Why don't we ever try this thought experiment in the opposite?
Yeah.
Watch them burn. I want to see it. I want to actually see Wall Street burn to the ground and normal everyday people's lives actually be affected by it. Yeah. Like it makes no sense to me. Like how can one be the case and not the other? But they never address that. I just thought it was funny how it was just like, well, of course we have to save the banks.
Well, the other thing that I found interesting, do you remember when he started talking about the way they did the tax subsidy and stimulus, and that Larry Summers convinced him to put it out like in little bits in people's like weekly paycheck rather than like one big lump sum payment, because like the social science said that people were more, you know, if they didn't realize they were getting an extra few bucks, they're more likely to spend it than if they got it in one lump payment. And that like that was a lesson that they learned, you know, that you need to like, it's better to just like give someone a big check and say like, this came from me, which is what Trump understood really well when he gave the $1,200
stimulus payment. Put my name on it.
He put his name on it, and the liberals are like, can you believe that he would put his name so on the check?
His big ugly and it's signature.
Like, of course, you fucking dumbasses. You have to tell people that you're giving them money. That's the most popular thing in the world. And that's something that Joe Biden didn't do when he gave the stimulus check. He didn't put his name on it, and now they're taking it away. They're taking away the unemployment insurance extension. They're like, they didn't learn those lessons. You know, they didn't learn them. Like, you have to sell people on your you have to defend your own policies, you know, and put your name on your own policies, especially the ones that help people, you know, like that yeah, that was like, to me, the most infuriating thing.
Yeah. And because Biden himself is, you know, he is a product of the Reagan era, and they are so scared of this meritocracy, lazy bums not getting what they deserve. But the numbers don't back that up, son. I'm sorry. Like, the stimulus was fucking broadly popular. Everybody understood the importance of getting money in their pockets, and they didn't give a fuck who else got it. You know, yeah. I understand that, like, normally when you talk to people specifically about SNAP and Medicaid and all of that kind of stuff, it's like, well, yeah, people should get it, but they should be people like me. They should be white, hardworking, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but in this situation, everybody's like, nah, I don't give a fuck who else gets this shit. I want it, I need it, and I'm glad that somebody gave it to me. And so, you know, it's hilarious. On the one hand, he does understand, like, with the earned tax credit, where he's just like, we should have just gave them that shit so that we could get the wins and everybody can understand, hello, Barry did that for you.
And he did talk about, he also did talk about like his campaign strategies. And I thought that this is like a lesson that Democrats have forgotten from the Obama years. Like, Obama won again as a black man whose middle name was Hussein, in the middle of, like, you know, at the height of the war on terror, George W. Bush, blah, 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 blah. He won like the white working class vote, you know, which is just like inconceivable for Democrats to do that now. And he did it despite his identity, right? And he talks about how he did it. He's like, I just didn't talk about my identity that much. I talked about my personal story. And I also talked about change. And I also talked about economics and regular people's lives. And that foregrounding an economic pitch to voters is always a good idea, right? That the liberal consensus has been to abandon that and to foreground identity and social issues, which are inherently divisive, you know, and people don't like them. You know, and instead of economic issues,
economics are divisive too, but in the way that we want.
Exactly. Yeah. The right division. But what happened in Georgia with the special elections, again, remember, it seems like a million years ago now, where the Democrats won two.
They put the money on the ballot. They put the money.
They're just like $2,000. That's all I'm talking about. Sometimes $2,000. Which they didn't even, by the way, they didn't even deliver on it, but that's what they talked about, and they won. It's like, how do they not learn these lessons? You know, like, how does the liberal press and the smarty pants commentators and Democratic Party politicians not learn these lessons? You know, that you have to foreground bread and butter issues that affect people's lives. Those things unite people. Social issues, the culture war, we always talk about it. The culture war is poison. Stay away from it. Stay the fuck away from it. It is the most poisonous thing in the world. It will poison your interpersonal relations, your family relations, and it's poisoned our politics. A class war unites people.
Everybody.
And that's what Obama understood.
Yes. And you know,
first of all, it's the thing is, like, they tried, his opponents, not just Mitt Romney and John McCain. Remember, John McCain, you know, nominated Sarah Palin as vice president. It was basically,
well, he just doesn't share our values.
Exactly. And but Hillary Clinton in the primary, it was the Hillary Clinton campaign that ran a disgusting race baiting campaign.
The
joint Obama.
with the turban on and all of that. Yeah,
they released that photo. They were like, oh, look, we just found this. You know, like, it was weird. You know, like, and Obama won despite the race baiting against him, because he never took the bait and because he foregrounded change in economic issues, which is what voters want everywhere, everywhere, not just in the United States, but in every democracy in the Western world. Voters want change and economic improvement. And if you foreground that, you're going to win. If you don't, you'll lose.
Yeah, I'm trying to go through my notes of some other notable notable things. Barry did his, you know, now people take my existence as a black man at the White House for granted. I was like, yo,
yeah,
Barry.
Yeah, he's such self-important.
Yo, Barry, you need to relax, bro. Like, we get it. You have beautiful children. Michelle is a beautiful woman, and, you know, very, she evokes a sort of power that resonates with so many different people, and I get all of that, but, like, yo, my man,
yeah.
And certain things that you touched on too, the Medicaid expansion being the most popular part of the Obamacare. Guys, let me tell you what Medicaid is. Free healthcare. That's what it is.
Government healthcare.
Free healthcare. That's the most popular part of Barry's fucking whack ass healthcare bill. Is the part of it that gave people free healthcare, free dental and vision. Free. That was the most popular part. It's like, what? It's like I wanted to bang my head on something. Like what is going on here?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the overall message was like, give people some stuff that works and then give them the benefit of the doubt. And it's like, yeah, Barry, you need to tell Joe Biden that. Again, and I don't want to sound like a broken horse here. I don't want to beat a dead horse or sound like a broken record.
Broken record.
You know, this shit is not very complicated as far as what we're talking about here. One, just stay vigilant about how everybody's framing things. Inflation is bad, but people working for slave wages is somehow a good, right? Like, people not want to get back quick is, that's fucked up. It might lead to inflation. Like, inflation that hasn't happened, by the way. Like, the actual fact of people working for horrible wages, not being able to pay their rent, et cetera, at these terrible jobs like Walmart, which is a fact, is somehow cool. And the potential for inflation, oh my God, just how everything is framed. I think slowly but surely, like, even in Barry's defiant tone about how I just did everything I could do, he could see, like, when he lamented the deficit hawks, he's like, finally those fuckers realized they were wrong. You could tell he's like, yeah, we missed it.
Yeah.
We missed it. Yeah. The Barry years, y'all missed it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, that's our show for today, guys. Make sure you're subscribed to every single Count the Dings offering. Make sure you subscribe to the individual Woke Bros feed. Go find that.
Whoa, we got a new one?
Yeah. We have our own feed now, Nando. Our own feed now. Go subscribe.
My mom has always been very confused. But it's like, wait, but your show is called Woke Bros. Why can't I find it? And it's like, I'm like, the bomb feed. She's like, the boom feed?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
Right. So now Woke Bros is individually. You can find it wherever you get iTunes, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Please subscribe to that. Of course, make sure you subscribe to Cinephobe and the Friday Mailbag and every single other Count the Dings offering. We'll see you guys next week. Shout out to producer Sean. We out of here. Peace.